It's December 27th. You're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
So, Jess, what do we have on the agenda for today's show?
Well, Duncan, you did promise the listeners that today we'd be discussing 1001 ways to make the happy human gingerbread person.
I did. Unfortunately, over this holiday, I have eaten 1001 happy human gingerbread cookies, and I'm about 10 pounds too heavy.
I was noticing an extra puff in your shirt, but...
Well, this is, you know, audio, so our listeners can't tell, but yes, my face is now too wide to fit through the door.
So, listeners out there, it's not the microphone adding 10 pounds to Duncan. He actually weighs 10 extra pounds since the last time you heard him.
I've been going up and down the stairs with Jess every hour.
Just there for moral support. I haven't added 10 pounds to my weight.
Well, just so you can envision this, though, Jess told me I should be pumping my arms while I'm going up down the stairs. That's so right. I've been carrying an unabridged Webster's dictionary with me. I've been pumping my arms with it.
That's because Duncan's saying my legs don't need it. I was like, well, you sound like your lungs need it, and maybe you should pump your arms some.
Yeah, well, Jess ate a quiche in front of me in the kitchen as I was stepping up onto a chair and back down again. They were kind of like squat thrust or something I was doing. you were there eating the quiche for moral support.
I was. Two pieces. I'm there for you, Duncan.
I know.
And
thanks.
Then he came up and ate two pieces of celery because that's what he eats.
All right. Yes. So we do have a show today. Who's on the show today, Jess?
Well, Duncan, we talked to Lori Littman Brown of the Secular Coalition for America, mm-hmm. and she was on the O'Reilly Factor discussing the war on Christmas.
The war on Christmas, that's right. We've got listener comments. Oh, Jess, you have your first solo interview on this show.
That's right. I spoke with Heidi Brugging of the Apignani Legal
Humanist Center.
Humanist Legal Center. Thank you.
Uh-huh. And we have a little bit of oral history today. Matt Cherry spoke with Ellery Shemp, who was involved in a landmark court case involving getting religion out of schools, prayer, and biblical readings.
And we have a listener essay from Jamila Bay about mm-hmm. Sort of a cross between 'Twas the Night Before Christmas and her New Year's resolution, or her call for a New Year's resolution on behalf of humanists and atheists all over the world.
Uh-huh.
All right. Why don't you tell these people what humanism is?
Humanism is a non-religious philosophy based on reason and compassion.
And have we heard anything about humanism or the Institute for Humanist Studies recently in the news?
Yes, IHS in the news. Well, there was a reporter from the Daily Gazette, which is a newspaper here in the Albany area, and he was working on a story about Festivus. Do you remember Festivus, Jess?
Festivus for the rest of us?
Yes. It's from Seinfeld. Anyone out there listening who hasn't seen this? Apparently, people around the country actually celebrate Festivus to various degrees of seriousness. Here's the section that includes the Institute for Humanist Studies. It says, Alan Salkin, author of Festivus, The Holiday for the Rest of Us' book. So here it goes. Even so, Salkin and other Festivus lovers point out how the holiday has a minimalist aesthetic represented by the clean pole that, according to the Frank Costanza character, requires no decoration. And the Festivus for the Rest of Us mantra hints at the need to find a secular, inclusive holiday, even if it's more campy than serious. That's one of the reasons Matt Cherry likes it. He's the executive director of the Institute for Humanist Studies in Albany, not to be confused with the Human Fund, the fake charity the George Costanza character makes up in the Festivus episode to avoid giving holiday gifts. Here's a quote. It doesn't take itself too seriously, but it does kind of remind us of a few facts about the holiday season, which people like Bill O'Reilly tend to forget, which is that no single group owns the holiday season, said Cherry.
Speaking of Bill O'Reilly, our next guest, Lori Littman Brown, who is the director and lobbyist of the Secular Coalition for America, recently appeared on the O'Reilly Factor. And now Bill O'Reilly is that guy who's making a big to-do about the atheists claiming that we're having this war on Christmas and we don't want anyone to be able to celebrate Christmas. And
well, it's the atheists and the Jews.
That's right.
And Lori Littman Brown is an atheist who's also culturally Jewish, I believe. So she's a double whammy for O'Reilly.
All right. Now, you spoke with Lori.
Yeah, I called her this morning, actually, and spoke to her.
Joining us now from Washington, Lori Lipman Brown, director of the Secular Coalition for America. You know, I tried to join up. You haven't? Did you get my application yet, Ms. Brown?
We don't have members, just supporters. You can sign up for our e-alerts
okay.
on secular.org.
Excellent. All right. Now, am I overdoing this?
So, Lori, I understand that Bill O'Reilly has applied for a membership with the Secular Coalition for America. Is that correct?
He did tell me he was having trouble getting on the list.
Maybe Fox News is on your spammer list or something?
Maybe.
So what's the deal? Bill O'Reilly is still talking about the war on Christmas. I haven't heard it as much this year as last year. So have we won this war, or what's going on?
Well, he seems to be on his own in terms of really focusing quite a bit on what's happening in department stores, because, you know, that's the reason for the season. Mm-hmm. But actually, there are some other warriors out there trying to make sure that everybody, no matter what their religion, celebrates Christmas. But
now, Lori, I didn't get to, I don't have cable, so I didn't get to see the whole Bill O'Reilly interview with you. But I did see a segment on Media Matters. It's a media watchdog, and they were concerned that Bill O'Reilly was not telling the truth about Best Buy and their policies. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened on the rest of the interview?
Well, I was really shocked to hear that there was some kind of problem with Best Buy's trying to stop the individual speech of their employees in terms of saying, you know, something like Merry Christmas, and that ACLU had taken on somebody's case. And I was confused because I didn't know about this lawsuit or whatever he was talking about. But apparently, according to Media Matters, it was all made up. So, or he had heard it from someone who heard it from someone.
Right.
But it wasn't the store's policy.
Right. Now,
anything he can do to invent a little war for himself, I'm sure it brings in a lot of money. I've been reading that they are making money off their war, so I guess it's a fundraiser thing.
Now, Lori, you were afraid after your second appearance on the O'Reilly Factor that you were too nice for O'Reilly.
Yeah, his producer had mentioned that I really needed to get angrier, you know, if I wanted to keep being on his show, basically. Mm-hmm. And I don't lose it. I don't get angry like that. So I was surprised a year later that they called me and wanted me again, and that the producer actually said, you know, Bill likes you. I said, oh, okay.
Well, he called you rational before your second appearance, I remember. He said, at least she's rational.
Well, maybe, but he may be using that in a negative sense. He thinks the word secular is a bad word.
Right. So, Lori, let's see, we have a few more days left in the Secular Coalition's Find the Highest Elected Non-Theist. How is that contest going?
It's been wonderful because now that we're near the deadline, we've started contacting the nominees. And we're giving the nominees three choices, just so everyone knows. They have a choice to say, yes, I am publicly identifying as non-theist, or no, I publicly identify and believe myself to be a theist. Or a third option, I really don't identify publicly because I think it's inappropriate in a political context to identify your theology. Mm-hmm. And the reason I want to make that clear to the listeners is I know there are people who've nominated people who, when they see that that's not the one that was the winner, are going to say, but I know he or she is a non-theist. Well, the thing is, they may have chosen the third option.
Right.
Still giving us the most wonderful entree with various elected officials around the country to be able to call them and say, you know, you've been nominated for this, and this is what my group does. And it's a really nice connection.
And Lori, what's next? When do you plan to announce the results? And is there going to be a ceremony or something like that? What can we expect in the near future?
The results we had hoped would be sometime in January, but it's looking like we're going to need the entire month of January to sift through the answers that we're getting, and you know, kind of make sure that we get responses on one of those three things from as many of these nominees as we can. So we're likely to have the winner in the first week of February.
Is there going to be a ceremony also?
We'll do a press conference at least, and
Great.
Possibly a ceremony. I think some of the prospective possible winners are probably up for that, having a ceremony to really focus on separation of church and state as regards their own minority status.
Well, you know, Lori, it would be great if you invited Ron Reagan Jr. to a to the press conference, because he had said on Larry King and also Fresh Air with Terry Gross that, you know, Terry was and Larry were both asking him, are you going to run for office? And he said, well, I'm an atheist, so the highest office I could get elected to is dog catcher. And I'd love to encourage him to say, hey, look, these people got elected to something higher than dog catcher.
Oh, that would be great. I will definitely try to get him to come to our press conference.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be great. So what's on the agenda for 2007 as far as lobbying?
The Secular Coalition for America, for the first time, will be proposing its own legislation. We already have a commitment from a congresswoman to introduce a bill to require that health insurers cover the HPV vaccine. I don't know if you've been following how the religious right doesn't want some girls to get that.
Yeah, they think that it's going to encourage premarital sex?
And apparently they believe if someone has premarital sex, then they should come down with something like, you know, cancer. So it's just bizarre. But that was nice that there's actually a Congress member who was just absolutely okay with introducing something for the non-theist group. And the other thing we're going to be working on that's a much bigger bite to chew is to take on the laws that privilege religion over other religions and non-religion. That would be what's called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. So things like mega churches not having to follow zoning and land use laws. And we're also very much involved in making sure that military proselytizing doesn't come back. We're working closely with a couple of people who are very involved in that in Congress. And accountability and faith-based initiatives. How could I forget that?
Great. Well, Lori, it's always a pleasure talking to you. It sounds like you got your hands full for 07, and I'm sure we'll hear from you again.
Thank you, Duncan.
All right. Thank you, Lori.
You were brainwashed by Christian cults. Once you had compassion for those of us different from you.
That was Duncan speaking with Lori Littman Brown of the Secular Coalition for America. They spoke earlier this morning by phone. And just to further prove that we humanists do enjoy celebrating and enjoy our traditions during the winter season, we asked our listeners and our readers to share with us how they celebrate these holidays. And you can visit our website at humanistnetworknews.org to learn about what they said. We heard from people from where, Duncan?
Canada, Europe, and New York City.
All foreign countries.
All foreign countries to us here in Albany.
New York.
Yeah, so you mean Bill O'Reilly is making a big deal about nothing?
Is that not the first time? That seems pretty common for him, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I know I've been camouflaged and running around the streets here in Albany, war raging war on Christmas, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, okay. Okay, we also heard from another Washington. The Secular Coalition for America is based in Washington, D.C. That's where Lori does her lobbying. And we spoke to another Washington, D.C. Based advocacy group, the Opignani Humanist Legal Center. And Jess had her first solo interview with Heidi Brugink, who is the legal coordinator for the Opignani Humanist Legal Center. That's a project of the American Humanist Association. I don't know if our listeners recall, but when Derek Arujo appeared on our show a few episodes ago, he had spoke about his volunteer work with the Legal Center. They now have their first lawsuit that's working its way through the courts regarding voting and religious polling places. Okay, so the center is named after Louis Opignani, who gave $50,000 to get this project off the ground, but I should point out that the Institute for Humanist Studies grant fund also contributed $15,000 for this project. Jess spoke with Heidi last week.
Heidi Brugink, the Abignani Humanist Legal Center has been active since spring of 2006, and your first solo litigation case is working with Jerry Rabinowitz in Florida on a lawsuit about his assigned polling place, which was a church, and it was in violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution. How did the Legal Center get involved in this case?
You know, it's kind of roundabout. We had been looking at this study that came out over the summer from Stanford's Graduate School of Business, which had showed that that environmental cues in polling locations had a measurable impact on voting results. And they looked at schools, but they conceded in their report that it could certainly be applied to churches and other environments as well. So that kind of raised our attention to it. And we had then emailed our members right before the election asking them to look out for any kind of violations, any egregious religious symbols, anything like that, and just report back to us. And so then we heard from Jerry, and it was just astonishing what he sent.
What kinds of things did Jerry see?
Well, luckily, Jerry is a professional photographer, so in addition to just reporting the things, he actually sent us pictures. And one of them is a gigantic anti-abortion sign right out front of the church with an enormous fetus on the front. And then in the inside of the church, there are multiple crucifixes. There's a sign saying, your voice matters to God right above the voting booth. There are Ten Commandments and Lord's Prayers and right there next to the machines.
Wow.
So it was pretty astounding. And when we looked at it, we just knew that this was definitely our first case.
Right. Do you know if Jerry is a humanist?
Jerry sympathizes with humanism. He is kind of a non-practicing Jew. Although I almost got the sense that the more he learns about humanism, the more he supports it. I can't really say for sure, though, that he is a humanist.
What other kinds of things did people who got in touch with you, what else did they see at the polling places that they visited or monitored?
You know, it was amazing. We received a lot of emails. One member in Illinois voted in a church that displayed a 4-foot wooden crucifix right above the election judges. another member in California had a large marble plaque dedicated to the unborn children who are killed by abortion, and containing a Bible quote justifying the notion that the soul is alive in the womb. This is also right there in the polling location.
Wow.
Yeah, and we also had a New York member voting in a room with large religious slogans on the wall, also right behind the voting machines.
Right.
And these are just kind of selected examples. There were quite a few.
Where does the case in Florida stand now?
Right now, we filed our complaint the last week of November, and we're basically just waiting. The other side, the supervisor of elections, has 60 days in which to reply. So we're waiting for that, and then we'll just kind of go forth. We're working on getting together what we want from discovery, what experts we'll have, hopefully getting in the authors of the Stanford study. So we're just kind of moving things along.
Right. Do you know what are the rules? What are the rules that churches have to follow as polling places?
You know, there are shockingly few. Right when we were looking at taking this case, the day after the election, I called the Palm Beach Supervisor of Elections office and asked them what sort of guidelines there were, not even just for churches, but for any sort of private building that uses a polling place, and they said there really isn't any. And the woman seemed somewhat astounded that I'd asked that. She said, you know, they loan us the buildings for the day, and we don't have the right to tell them anything, which is not completely true, but as far as it stands, there really is no uniform rule. Certain places around the country, I think, do have rules, but it seems to be on a really scattered basis.
So you're saying it's state by state, but there's not a federal rule of what has to be done?
There's not, no.
Okay. Do you know what's the percentage of churches that are polling places, or I guess polling places that are churches?
It depends on the state, but nationwide, actually, it's the most common place to vote. Churches are over 40%. In parts of Florida, they're actually over 60%. Illinois, it's also incredibly high, over half.
Is there that seems awfully high to me. Is there any inclination of why that is?
You know, I don't really know exactly why that is. I know in some cities it's that there is an abundance of churches, and it's easier for them to use. This would be my guess more, because they don't say why.
Right.
But my guess would be that it's easier to use a building that they don't have to deal very much with. You know, it's pretty much just for the day. I think, too, as schools have had more security concerns, that's been used as justification for the expanding use of churches, that metal detectors, things like that, make it difficult to vote at a school. But, you know, frankly, I think that's enough. But, you know, quite honestly, I don't know exactly why they're so widespread.
Well, I guess politically it makes sense if I have a message that I want to be, you know, to be heard for someone at the very last minute, you know.
Absolutely.
So you're hoping to have lawsuits in other states as well as Florida. What's your ultimate goal here? Are you looking for a federal ban of churches as polling places?
You know, that would be ideal. I mean, we were very clear about our, you know, our aims in this. We obviously, number one, want to win on behalf of a specific case.
Right.
But we wouldn't be taking it on as the first lawsuit for the Appignani Humanist Legal Center if it didn't have a broader perspective. So we'd like to have all voting in churches ruled to be a violation of the Establishment Clause. You know, the way that happens might work out depending on a variety of different factors. What may happen is that if we bring this case in several different districts and win, you know, supervisor of elections will start to think this is a very bad idea and you could get sued
right.
if you continue it. But I mean, yeah, the ultimate goal would be to have it simply declared a violation and banned.
And how can other humanists out there, or how can people in general, how can they get involved in that process?
You know, I think the first thing would be urging people who've had this experience to contact us. We're, like I said, we're going to be filing in multiple locations, and really the better documented, you know, the more useful it is to us, too. And just in other things, to support us, to look at, you know, our website, to learn more about the legal center, you know, just to kind of get the word out as well in their own communities that other people are upset by this, that this is, you know, beyond just the AHA's concerns, that many other people and IHS and everybody else that we work with, to show that this really impacts a lot of people and that it's really important to address.
Right. Well, thanks for giving us a snapshot of what the Legal Center is up to now. Can you tell us a little bit more, or give us some background about the Legal Center and the American Humanist Association in general?
Well, the AHA obviously has been around for quite a while, but and we have actually been involved in court fights for quite a long time. But you know, a lot of that had been on the amicus level. So the Legal Center was founded basically so that we could take the lead in cases that we find very important in standing up for the rights of humanists and religious minorities. So it's been a really exciting process, and we now have Jim McCollum, Wendy Kaminer, Mike Newdow, and a variety of other attorneys who have joined up with us, and we're expanding pretty rapidly, actually.
That's great.
So yeah, we've written amicus letters for Mike Newdow in his pledge case in the Ninth Circuit, the Mount Soledad case also in the Ninth Circuit, and are just kind of, you know, evaluating a variety of cases right now, and expect to continue you know, taking the lead and doing amicus activity for the foreseeable future, for hopefully the very long future.
Right, I'm excited to see what you guys get involved in. That's great. Well, great. Thank you so much for speaking with me, Heidi.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome.
People are so nice, so give one a chance. Yeah. Like in the 70s.
Hi, this is Gregory Tucker in Dallas, Texas, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News Podcast.
I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. We were just listening to an interview with Jess and Heidi Brugink, legal coordinator for the Opignani Humanist Legal Center based in Washington, D.C. That's a program of the American Humanist Association. Before that, we heard a bumper from an H&N listener who just called our listener line and recorded that little announcement letting you know that you're listening to the Humanist Network News. And we would love to have all of our listeners out there feel free to call up our listener line and record a bumper. So, Jess, what's that listener comment line?
206-339-4168.
Do we have any listener comments this month?
Boy, do we ever.
Hey, this is Zebulon Wilcox, Associate Pastor Reverend of Papa Creek Church of God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost down here in Boomer, Georgia. And I got a comment for your little podcast. Part of my job duties at the church is to scour the internet for dark-sided podcasts, you understand? And guess what? I've discovered your dark-sided little thing you got going there. Talking about you don't need Jesus to be a good person. No, you got to have Jesus or you ain't no good person. You're dark-sided. And I heard your podcast about these homosexuals, about how homosexuals are, you know, not evil, and about how, you know, atheists got it worse than homosexuals. And you know what? You're all bad as far as I'm concerned, you understand? You know, you're talking about, oh, I don't like homosexuals because they don't have as bad as us atheists. Well, guess what? Y'all bad. Guess what? You got this director, your director talking, oh, the Pope is bad and Muslims are good. Guess what? Christian's good, you understand? Anything other than Christian is bad. It's simple. You're dark-sided. That's just it. And you know what? You ain't going to play this message because when you play this message on your little show, guess what everybody's going to be like? I'm going to go to Jesus now. All your little humanists, dark-sided humanists out there going to be like, oh, I need Jesus in my life. You know, I don't need these humans. I need Jesus, you understand? And, you know, and you're not going to let them know that they need to go to www.poplarcreekchurch.homestead.com because that's where they find the real truth, not your little humanist network, okay? Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Well, listeners, have you instantly converted to Christianity?
Have we lost you? Are you dropping by the dozens?
Have you converted, Jess?
I haven't. Have you?
No. What was the name of that church again?
The Poplar Creek Church of God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost, I think. I'm not entirely sure.
In case you couldn't hear the URL, folks, that's www.poplarcreekchurch.homestead.com. You can check that. This is a church in a trailer home.
Now, they also have a podcast.
No, I think that it's called a podcast.
I think you're right. And it happens to be hosted by...
Oh, Libsyn, yeah.
Right, the same company that hosts us.
Yep, poplarcreekchurch.libsyn.com.
We need your advice. I mean, is this a real comment, do you think? Is this a real church? Do we have reason to be worried?
Yeah, I think if you spend a little time on this website, you might... You might have some questions as to whether or not it's real. What's the listener comment line, Jess?
206-339-4168 line.
All right, we got another call.
Hello, Duncan and Company. This is Frederico, or just Fred from Connecticut calling. Third call in. Congratulations on a great year as we approach the year end. Hope you're getting a lot more listeners and a lot more feedback. Looking forward to new and better material for the next year because you guys keep raising the bar. That's good. And I'm also going to piggyback a question. Up here in Connecticut, or even the New England area, what's the best humanist group you can suggest sort of hooking up with? And I know Connecticut's near New York, so I don't want the New York affiliation. I'm wondering if there's something uniquely New England or Connecticut oriented. Thanks a bunch, and happy holidays to everyone. Take care now.
Another excellent comment from our number one fan in Connecticut.
Now, have we been calling you Brett this whole time, Fred? Or are we now calling you Fred? Brett, can you leave us one more comment so that we can get it right? Apparently, we don't have that good of a hearing.
Yeah, well, Jess and I started thinking that maybe we've been using the wrong name here. But either way, Fred or Brett, thank you for your comment. First of all, I want to address one issue. New and better.
Yeah, what's the deal with that?
we'll definitely try to tighten it up here. That's our New Year's resolution. But I did do some research. I can't name the best humanist group. That wouldn't be fair. But I did check out the 2004 Free Thought Directory, which I have in my office. It's published by the Atheist Alliance International. And I went to the Connecticut listings. and I found a few. There is the Humanist Association of Central Connecticut, which is a chapter of the American Humanist Association. Their website is cthumanist.org. They have a monthly meeting held on the third Monday of the month at the Unitarian Society of New Haven. There's also a New England Skeptical Society, and their website is thenes.com. That's thenes.com. Let's see, who else do we have here? We have a Congregation for Humanistic Judaism in Fairfield County, and that website is humanisticjews.org. I'm going to go ahead and post a few more listings on our website at humanistnetworknews.org.
Thank you, Duncan. Now, we had one final comment that was sent to us through our website, as Duncan just mentioned, humanistnetworknews.org. Now, this was written in by Paula Thomas, and I will read her comment now. Hi, all. I've been listening to the Humanist Network News podcast and like them very much. I can't send in a listener comment on Skype because my speech is difficult to understand as I have cerebral palsy. Couple points. Whilst Matt is correct about the lower profile of religion in the UK, we are currently facing an attempt by a group called Truth in Science to introduce intelligent design into the science classroom in British schools. The government has put out a statement. Now, I can't read the URL for the article, but basically it's at The Guardian's website, which is guardian.co.uk, and you can go to the education section. The date that it was put out was December 7th, 2006, and the article is called Ministers to Ban Creationalist Teaching Aids in Science Lessons. Do you think that the greater adherence to religion in the U.S. has anything to do with the fact that the Pilgrim Fathers wrote Religious Fanatics Escaping Persecution in Britain? And a comment on your sex show. Did you know that before Henry VIII, the church in England, at the time Roman Catholic, obtained some of its funding from prostitution? I don't know whether the book is still in print, but it was written up by E.J. Burford in The Bishop's Brothels, available through Amazon.com. If you're interested, indeed it has been suggested that some of the convents were little more than brothels themselves. Perhaps that is why nun was, for a long time, the slang term for prostitute. Thank you very much for introducing me to the music of Holly Near. I had not been aware of her music in activism before. Best wishes, Paula Thomas.
All right. You can leave a listener comment for us by calling 206-339-4168.
That's it for listener comments. What do we have next, Duncan?
Next, we're going to hear from Ellery Shemp. Matt Sherry, the executive director of the Institute for Humanist Studies, spoke with Ellery last week. We have sort of a theme of today's show with humanist legal activism. And Ellery Shemp was involved as a student in the landmark 1963 United States Supreme Court case of Abington School District v. Shemp, which declared that public school sanctioned Bible readings were unconstitutional. This was part of the Madeline Murray, or part of the reason why Madeline Murray O'Hare is considered one of the most hated atheists in America, or she was at the time. But Ellery was involved with this ACLU lawsuit before Madeline Murray O'Hare got involved. And November 26th, 1956 was the date that Ellery first wrote his letter to the ACLU to ask for help as a student who was being forced to participate in Bible readings in school. So this is the 50th anniversary of that. Matt spoke with Ellery by phone last week.
Ellery, can you tell us what you did 50 years ago on November the 26th, 1956?
Well, on that day, I made a protest at school about the practice of Bible reading and the recitation of the Lord's Prayer. And I did this by not paying attention during Bible reading. And in fact, what I did is brought a copy of the Koran. I read that sitting at my desk quietly to myself, of course. And I only chose the Koran because it was available. It could have been the Bhagavad Gita or something, but I just wanted to show that there were other holy books in the Bible. And I didn't stand up for the Lord's Prayer, and that became rather obvious, I suppose. Then I jumped to my feet and did the flag salute. And of course, I was, my homeroom teacher was rather shocked. I was a junior in high school in suburban Philadelphia in Abington Township at that time. So he sent me to the principal, and the principal was also rather shocked because I wasn't one of those kids who got in trouble all the time. I was told that I should, obey the school rules, and I came home that afternoon and evening, talked to my folks, and told them what had happened. And I sat down and I wrote a letter to the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU in Philadelphia. And in that letter, I simply asked if they would be interested in helping what I considered to be a violation of the First Amendment principles, and sent it off with a $10 bill, which turned out to be significant because the ACLU was feeling poor, and they thought it was very nice that a 16-year-old boy would be able to save up enough money to include $10. And that was 1956 money, so $10 was worth a bit.
Now, what was the upshot of that letter?
After, I think about 6 months, the ACLU voted to take on the Bible reading cases.
Now, it sounds like your parents are very supportive of you at this time.
Well, it was absolutely essential that my parents were supportive because 16-year-olds don't have the right to bring any cases to court. And so the case had to be filed by my parents in the name of their three children, myself, my younger brother Roger, and my younger sister Donna. This is one reason why the case actually succeeded getting all the way to the Supreme Court, because it was essential that I had that there was somebody who was still affected by the law. Under the U.S. Law, you can't bring a case in the abstract. There has to be somebody who was actually being affected by the law that you're challenging. And up to the time of the final hearing before the Supreme Court, which was in February of 1963, so fortunately my siblings were still in school at that time. Otherwise, the case would have been called moot, that is, no longer of legal relevance. And it was so essential that I grew up in a family where I knew about the existence of the ACLU.
Right. Well, it's great to have a supportive family, but what about the other kids at the school and the community in general?
Well, two years later, I graduated and went off to college. Roger and Donna were harassed a little bit at school. Roger was pushed and shoved around a couple times. Donna was mortified. She was the one, I think, who really felt the pressure most. Even to this day, she somehow feels a sense of embarrassment about it, although she agrees entirely intellectually that she has, I guess you might call it an emotional scar.
Now, what happened when the case got to the Supreme Court?
Since we had won at the district court level, we won twice, as it turns out, because the Pennsylvania legislature changed the law a little bit, and the Supreme Court the first time decided that it should be reheard in the light of the changed law. So the Supreme Court agreed to take it in the fall of 1962, and the hearing was in February of 1963, and the final decision was rendered on June 17th of 1963.
A lot of people credit or perhaps blame Madeline Murray O'Hare for taking prayer out of public schools. What was her involvement in this case?
Well, her case began entirely independently. Our first hearing was on August 5th of 1958 at the district court in Philadelphia. And I happen to remember that because that happened to be my birthday. And I testified on the stand, and so did my parents, and so did Roger and Donna, about the nature of the practices and what our objections were. But Madeline Murray's case began in Baltimore. Her first hearing was in 1960. Her case went up through the state courts, from the Baltimore Municipal Court up through the Supreme Court of Maryland. And from that, and she had been on the losing side, so she appealed to the Supreme Court. In October or so of 1962, the Supreme Court agreed to hear both cases, and they decided that the cases presented substantially the same issue, so they decided that the entire case would be heard at once, and that case would be called Abington, School District of Abington versus Shemp, and Murray versus Curlett.
So
one decision for both cases.
Right. And do you feel that the case would have been won for either of them if your case had gone ahead without hers, or indeed hers had gone ahead without yours?
I think so. I mean, we had very, very strong opinions from the federal district court. When we first won, the court rendered an opinion that said that the practice of reading 10 verses of the Holy Bible at the beginning of each school day in Pennsylvania was a clear violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. And because in the original law there was no provision for a child to be excused from it, it also violated the Free Exercise Clause. So that was a very, very powerful decision. And even after the law was amended to allow a child to be excused, and that's why there was a second hearing, the court said that it's still a violation of the Establishment Clause, and we're not even convinced that allowing a child to be excused solves the problem of free exercise, because how would a child actually be exempted from it by going and standing in the hall, or anyhow it would require the child to make some kind of self-identification of being a dissenter or a non-believer or something. So anyhow, we had those powerful decisions. Now, Madeline Murray, she had her own powerful arguments, but she had actually lost in the courts. But I thought it was good for the Supreme Court to see that different kinds of religious background could have the same objection. I mean, we were members of a Unitarian church. Madeline Murray was a pronounced atheist, of course. Unitarians are very free-thinking, and they range all the way from having Christian believers to atheists and humanists among the UUs. But nonetheless, the fact that we were members of a church, nobody knew what a Unitarian church was, but it had that magic word church in it, you see, that gave us an awful lot of protection.
You're listening to an interview with Matt Cherry and Ellery Shemp. 50 years ago, Ellery was responsible for the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case, which declared that public school-sanctioned Bible readings were unconstitutional. In the next portion of the interview, you're going to hear about how Madeline Murray O'Hare was involved in this case as well. And keep in mind as you listen that when Ellery refers to the Shemp family, he's talking about his own family.
So how did you, and I guess your parents, feel about Madeline getting so much of the limelight afterwards, and also getting so much of the blame, because she really became a lightning rod that people blamed for taking religion out of our schools?
Well, first of all, we had no objection, but actually I was no objection to her getting a lot of attention. She was actually described by Time magazine as the most hated woman in America. One of the things that we learned, we got about 5,000 letters, and they broke into fairly neatly into thirds. About a third were supportive, about two-thirds were against us. But thing that about the two-thirds against us, they also split in half. And one-third were where reasonable men could differ, and these usually had return addresses, and my folks actually replied to them, to everyone that had a return address. The final third, of course, was just full of hate, vituperative and just really nasty. Some of them included excrement, it was, whatever. But the thing that we really learned was that we were accused of being everything the writer disliked. We would get letters that said, "What are you, Jews? What are you, niggers? What are you, Catholics? What are you, Nazis? What are you, communists?" And after about 100 or so of these, you just wonder about this kind of irrational hatred. But we did see one thing. It was bad to be a Nazi. It was very, very bad to be a communist. But it was really awful to be an atheist. And when people called us, "you communist atheist," they shot their wad. They didn't know any, they couldn't think of anything worse to call us. So we learned that atheists are the most hated group in America. And I think this is very sad. And it was because Madeline Murray was an outspoken atheist. That's why so much hate went to her.
Right. Now, did you have much?
It was really quite terrible what happened to her in Baltimore. I mean, I could only liken it to that of the situation of a civil rights worker in Mississippi in the bad old days. Her kids were beaten up on the way home from school many times. They would miss a day, and then when they had to go back, they would find the entire system was against them. Teachers would say, "Oh, you missed a math exam, you missed an English essay, you missed a history quiz, you missed this, right? You missed 3 days worth of homework," and they were penalized every which way. And when their house was firebombed, the fire department took a particularly circuitous route to get there so that they would get there late and all that sort of thing. So she suffered tremendously, and we did not.
Right. And it didn't stop her. I mean, she kept on campaigning, even though she had to move to different cities and persecution.
Absolutely. And in fact, the reason that she eventually left Baltimore was because there was a trumped-up charge against her for resisting arrest and for assaulting a police officer. And it all happened when the police came on one occasion. I don't know what it was at that point. But Madeline had an elderly mother. She was 85 or something. And apparently tried to hit the policeman over the head with a frying pan. and they took that incident and, you know, tried to make a federal case out of it.
Now, did you have much contact with Madeline and William Murray after the cases?
Not very much. Of course, we had met both her younger son, Garth, who I think changed his name to Robert, but I'm not wasn't sure about that, and her older son, Bill. And Bill made a major break with his mother and became an outspoken evangelical Christian. And he we were always sort of amazed at this division in the family. But Madeline came to have a dislike for the Shemps, and for a very odd reason, I thought. I mean, Madeline was noted for sometimes being flying off the handle. But she came to think that the Shemps had somehow stolen from her the true credit for the court case. And that it was a part of a conspiracy on the Supreme part of the Supreme Court to put the Shemp name first and Mary second. I, of course, have no idea how the Supreme Court actually organized. I've been trying to find this out, how the Supreme Court decides which name to put first, whether it was alphabetical or by incidences of timing or whatever. So that anyhow, the case finally got, you know, truncated so that it's not called School District of Abington versus Shemp, but it's often referred to as simply the Shemp case. And Madeline resented that, and she thought it was the Shemps were part of the conspiracy to rob her of her glory, or, you know, some other group was behind this. So there are people in the American Atheists to this day who don't like to talk about it with me.
That seems very unfortunate, since obviously we're all on the same side. Now, it's been almost 50 years since the Supreme Court decided that we couldn't have prayers or teacher-led prayers in public schools. What do you think are the consequences of that momentous change 50 years ago?
I think the schools are better off for this, and children in the schools are better off for this as a result of this, because the notion of having a Christian religious practice in the schools shows a kind of government favoritism towards the Bible, for example, as opposed to other holy books, and shows a favoritism towards Christian prayers as opposed to non-religious people. And I think that, and I think that religion has a, well, of course, it has an important role to play in many people's lives, but I think the schools are supposed to be neutral zones, and are function in schools, the function of schools is for learning, for education, for kids learning about the world around us. And when you have these kinds of overt religious practices, then that sort of tilts the way kids would understand the world, for example. I mean, there's many things about Bible beliefs and Noah's flood and various things contradictory to science. And, you know, there's efforts nowadays to put in so-called intelligent design or creationism into the public schools. And I think that having a religious practice would only encourage that kind of thing. And I also, I objected to the Bible reading for several reasons, but one of the major ones was it seemed to me to be really unfair. I mean, the Bible, as I said, is not the holy book for the Buddhists or Hindus or Muslims. And I saw that my Jewish friends were sort of cringing when Easter and Christmas stories were read. And I thought that since we have the First Amendment, and I thought there was a very clear understanding of what the Founding Fathers intended about separation of government and religion, I thought it showed disrespect for the First Amendment and for the Constitution in general for the schools to be promoting something that was clearly in violation. So I thought that that the decision was a very important one, and I'm very happy for it.
I mean, I think the decision was a great rallying cry for the religious right too. I mean, before we had Roe versus Wade, and now we have a big controversy over same-sex marriage. But before those issues, the religious right did a lot of fundraising, a lot of organizing, a lot of political campaigning based on trying to get prayer back into schools. Do you feel that the religious right has been stronger than you expected back then, that they've lasted longer, and it's still surprising that this is controversial even 50 years later?
I am disappointed that it's still controversial 50 years later. It's sort of interesting that initially there was a huge outcry, and it was clearly unpopular in many parts of the United States. It's still a little bit interesting that about 30 states had some kind of Bible reading and prayer practices in the schools. Mostly were in the South and the North, Northeast. And as you went further west, fewer and fewer states and schools had these practices. But at any rate, many people were kind of outraged because they had this notion that somehow prayer is helpful to kids. Well, this is a religious view, of course, that I don't share. And as I said, I still think that it was good for the schools to have to be in a neutral position. Anyhow, initially there was attempts to have Congress pass a constitutional amendment to overturn the court's decision. But that failed to get a two-thirds majority. And then the issue, and it failed actually for a rather interesting reason. Not so much because atheists and humanists and Unitarian Universalists and ethical culture continued to uphold the Supreme Court's view on this matter, but because organized religion, the National Council of Christian Churches, came to testify eventually that they thought that religion by rote was a cheapening of religion. And they thought that that separation of church and state was good for religion as well as for the government. So it was actually the voices of the mainstream Christian denominations that I think prevented the amendment from passing. But anyhow, after that initial attempt, the issue kind of died down. I mean, there were certainly groups that kept agitating for it. The last serious effort to amend the Constitution was during the Ronald Reagan administration, but that also failed to get a two-thirds vote out of the Congress. And interestingly enough, it is actually not as as high on the agenda of the religious right today as you might think. They're going after issues such as teaching intelligent design or teaching abstinence and in terms of sex education and all sorts of other things. And so the issue of prayer in the public schools, I think maybe they have given up on, or maybe they have come to realize that it is a basically unfair kind of notion. In addition, of course, the Supreme Court did not, as I say, as Senator Eastland said, put the niggers in school and thrown God out. But the Supreme Court did not throw the Bible out of the public schools. It's what it said is that you can't have a ceremonial, devotional kind of exercise around religion. But if you want to teach religion as literature, or teach the Bible as literature, or even as history, or if you want to have a class in which you teach about religion, and which you treat all religions fairly, that's entirely constitutional. And in fact, I would encourage it. I think more kids should learn about the different religions of the world.
I want to thank you for the groundbreaking work that you did in helping to separate church and state and create a more secular environment for our school children and for all Americans.
Well, I thank you very much for those kind remarks, and I'd like to remind people that it wasn't just me, that it couldn't have happened without the support of my parents and family, and certainly not without the support of the ACLU.
That was an interview with Ellery Shemp and Matt Cherry. 50 years ago, Ellery Shemp was involved in the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case, which declared public school-sanctioned Bible readings unconstitutional. Ellery lives in Boston, and he continues to be a dedicated Unitarian Universalist and a strong supporter of the ACLU.
As you all know, the new year is approaching, and at this most resolute time of the year, commentator Jamila Bay had a magically reasonable experience.
'Twas the night before New Year's, and one might have thunk I'd be out at some party, a rip-roaring drunk. Oh no, I'm sure alcohol's no solution. Besides, just last year, I wrote a resolution. And my cute little nightie, all red, silk, and lacy, had sure done its job to drive lover boy crazy. He lay next to me all sweetly and snoring, just plumb tuckered out from our evening of scoring copies of Battlestar Galactica. So instead I was tucked and lying next to my dearest, curled up with a volume of beloved Sam Harris. When all of a sudden I heard something scary, damn was I sure it was no fracking tooth fairy. Since I live in D.C., I expected no fun, 'cause in keeping with law here, I can't own a gun. From under my bed, I grabbed my aluminum bat, and I heard a voice bellow, "What you doing with that?" And before I could choke out a witty reply, I was oh so dismayed that my mouth had gone dry. I looked up, my jaw dropped, all I could do was stare into the visage of Madeline Murray O'Hare. Her gray hair was short and cut close to her head, and I said to her, "Madam, forgive me, you're dead, and I wish I could buy all that life after death, but to see you here now just takes away my breath, and I'm sure that you must be some hallucination brought on by my overactive imagination. I'm sober and straight, and I'm a really good gal, but above it all, let's say I'm too rational. So forgive me for being an ungracious host, but the truth of the matter, I don't believe in ghosts." And despite my soliloquy filled up with reason, old Lady O'Hare, well, she just breezed in into my bedroom, and she sat right on down on my chaise lounge where I'd left my flannel nightgown. Her eyes, how they flashed with incredible fury. If anyone would believe me, it'd make quite a story. She sat there with a paper balled up in her fist, and she said to me, "Listen, I've written a list of all of the work atheists have left to do, and hard work it'll be. You can believe that that's true. I'm tired of you hiding like scared little rabbits. 07's the year to break all of those habits that leave truth believers hiding in shame of being identified as atheists by name. So I give you tonight your own authority to send out a message to everybody who cares about what is important and true that going along anymore simply won't do. I want you to use your inalienable right to call yourself humanist, atheist, bright, secular, reasoner, whatever you like, but stop living in fear of the religious Reich. And you know who else you should kick in the tush? That right-wing full zealot George W. Bush." And she looked at me, sighed, and put her finger to cheek. And she told me, "Get working, there's truth left to seek." She rose up and looked at my dressing table, picked up the remote, and then turned on the cable. O'Reilly was on. He was ranting some mess. I don't quite remember about what, I confess. And she told me, "My dear, it's been quite exquisite, but I've so many others I must pay a visit. So get up, get dressed, and above all, get active. It's your choice what to do. The right's got that hack there." But I heard her exclaim as she left from my sight, "What the hell are you waiting for? Get out there and fight."
That was commentator and comedian Jamila Bey. I love Jamila.
Jamila rocks.
Yeah, she's cool. You can check her out on MySpace at myspace.com/Jamila Bey. That's JAMILABEY. And she's one of our top friends at myspace.com/humanist studies.
Hey, Duncan, what's your New Year's resolution?
I'm going to maintain one eyebrow this year on my fat face.
As opposed to the unibrow that you've been sporting in 2006?
Exactly. What's yours?
No wheat and no sugar for at least 30 days.
All right. Well, we want to hear all your New Year's resolutions out there, people. So call our listener comment line at
206-339-4168.
The Humanist Network News podcast is made possible by the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism.
Our theme music has been generously donated by musician Holly Near.
Check out hollynear.com for more information.
Visit us on MySpace/humanist studies or our website, humanistnetworknews.org.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm Jess Constantine.
Thanks for listening.